This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Wars of Gods and Men by Zechariah Sitchin. Narrated by Stephen Bell Davies. Publisher's note. This audiobook is packaged with bonus material, which has been included on the first audio and MP3 CD. If you downloaded this audiobook in a digital format, please visit Tantor.com and type The Wars of Gods and Men into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then click on PDF Extra 1. When prompted, enter the access code TABLETS to access the bonus material. Forward. Long before man warred with man, the gods battled among themselves. Indeed, it was the wars of the gods that the wars of man began, and the wars of the gods for control of this earth had begun on their own planet. It was thus that mankind's first civilization succumbed to a nuclear holocaust. This is fact, not fiction. It has all been written down long ago in the Earth Chronicles. Chapter 1. The Wars of Man. In the spring of 1947, a shepherd boy searching for a lost sheep in the barren cliffs overlooking the Dead Sea discovered a cave that contained Hebrew scrolls hidden inside earthenware jars. Those and other scrolls found in the area in subsequent years, collectively spoken of as the Dead Sea Scrolls, had lain undisturbed for nearly 2,000 years, carefully wrapped and hidden away during the turbulent years when Judea challenged the might of the Roman Empire. Was this part of the official library of Jerusalem, carted away to safety before the city and its temple fell in A.D. 70? Or, as most scholars assume, a library of the Essenes, a sect of hermits with messianic preoccupations? The opinions are divided, for the library contained both traditional biblical texts, as well as writings dealing with the sect's customs, organization, and beliefs. One of the longest and most complete scrolls, and perhaps the most dramatic, deals with a future war, a kind of final war. Titled by scholars, The War of the Sons of Light Against the Sons of Darkness, it envisages spreading warfare, local battles that will first involve Judea's immediate neighbors, which shall increase in ferocity and scope until the whole ancient world would be engulfed. The first engagement of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness, that is, against the army of Belial, shall be an attack upon the troops of Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, and the Philistine area, then upon that of the Kittians of Assyria, and upon those violators of the covenant who give them aid. And after those battles, they shall advance upon the Kittians of Egypt, and in due time against the kings of the north. In this war of men, the scroll prophesied, the God of Israel shall take an active role. On the day the Kittians fall, there shall be mighty combat and carnage in the presence of the God of Israel, for that is the day which he appointed of old for the final battle against the sons of darkness. The prophet Ezekiel had already prophesied the last battle in the latter days, involving Gog and Magog, in which the Lord himself shall smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thine right hand. But the Dead Sea Scroll went further, foreseeing the actual participation of many gods in the battles, engaged in combat side by side with mortal men. On that day, the company of the divine and the congregation of the mortals shall engage side by side in combat and carnage. The sons of light shall battle against the sons of darkness, with a show of godlike might, amid uproarious tumult, amid the war cries of gods and men. Though crusaders, Saracens, and countless others in historical times have gone to war in the name of God, the belief that in a war to come the Lord himself shall be actually present on the battlefield, and that gods and men would fight side by side, sounds as fantasy, to be treated allegorically at best. Yet it is not as extraordinary a notion as it may appear to be, for in earlier times it was indeed believed that the wars of men were not only decreed by the gods, but were also fought with the gods' active participation. One of the most romanticized wars, when love had launched 1,000 ships, was the War of Troy, between the Achaean Greeks and the Trojans. It was, know we not, launched by the Greeks to force the Trojans to return the beautiful Helen to her lawful spouse. Yet an epic Greek tale, the Cripia, represented the war as a premeditated scheme by the great god Zeus. There was a time when thousands upon thousands of men encumbered the broad bosom of the earth, and having pity on them, Zeus, in his great wisdom, resolved to lighten earth's burden. So he caused the strife at Ilion, Troy, to that end, that through death he might make a void in the race of men. Homer, the Greek storyteller who related the war's events in the Iliad, blamed the whim of the gods for instigating the conflict and turning and twisting it to its ultimate major proportions. Acting directly and indirectly, sometimes seen and sometimes unseen, the various gods nudged the principal actors of this human drama to their fates. And behind it all was Jove, Jupiter, Zeus. While the other gods and the armed warriors on the plain slept soundly, Jove was awake, for he was thinking how to do honor to Achilles and destroy much people at the ships of the Achaeans. Even before the battle was joined, the god Apollo began the hostilities. He sat himself down away from the ships with a face as dark as night, and his silver bow rang death as he shot his arrow in the midst of them, the Achaeans. For 9 whole days he shot his arrows among the people, and all day long the pyres of the dead were burning. When the contending sides agreed to postpone hostilities so that their leaders might decide the issue in hand-to-hand combat, the unhappy gods instructed the goddess Minerva, "Go at once into the Trojan and Achaean hosts, and contrive that the Trojans shall be the first to break their oaths and set upon the Achaeans." Eager for the mission, Minerva shot through the sky as some brilliant meteor. A fiery train of light followed in her wake. Later on, lest the raging warfare cease for the night, Minerva turned night into day by lighting up the battlefield. She lifted the thick veil of darkness from their eyes, and much light fell upon them, both on the side of the ships and on where the fight was raging, and the Achaeans could see Hector and all his men. As the battles raged on and on, sometimes pitching one hero against another, the gods, too, kept a watchful eye over individual warriors, swooping down to snatch away a beleaguered hero or to steady a driverless chariot. But when the gods and goddesses, finding themselves on opposing sides, began to hurt each other, Zeus called a halt, ordering them to keep out of the mortals' fighting. The respite did not last long, for many of the leading combatants were sons of gods or goddesses, by human mates. Especially angered was Mars, when his son Ascalaphus was pierced to death by one of the Achaeans. "Do not blame me, ye gods that dwell in heaven, if I go to the ships of the Achaeans and avenge the death of my son." Mars announced to the other immortals, "Even if in the end I shall be struck by Jove's lightning and shall lie in blood and dust among the corpses." So long as the gods held themselves aloof from the mortal warriors, wrote Homer, the Achaeans were triumphant, for Achilles, who has long refused to fight, was now with them. But in view of the mounting anger among the gods, and the help the Achaeans were now getting from the demigod Achilles, Jove changed his mind. For my own part I shall stay here, seated on Mount Olympus, and look on in peace. But you others, do go among the Trojans and Achaeans, and help either side as you might be disposed. Thus spake Jove, and gave the word for war, whereon the gods took their several sides and went into battle. The Battle of Troy, indeed Troy itself, were long thought of as just part of the fascinating but incredible Greek legends, which scholars have tolerantly called mythology. Troy, and the events pertaining to it, were still considered to be purely mythological, until Charles MacLaren suggested back in 1822 that a certain mound in eastern Turkey, called Hisarlik, was the site of the Homeric Troy. It was only when a businessman named Henrik Schliemann, risking his own money, came up with spectacular discoveries as he dug up the mound in 1870 that scholars began to acknowledge the existence of Troy. It is now accepted that the Battle of Troy had actually taken place in the 13th century BC. It was then, according to the Greek sources, that gods and men had fought side by side. In such beliefs, the Greeks were not alone. In those days, though the tip of Asia Minor facing Europe and the Aegean Sea were dotted with what were essentially Greek settlements, Asia Minor proper was dominated by the Hittites. Known at first to modern scholars only from biblical references, then from Egyptian inscriptions, the Hittites and their kingdom, Hatti, also came to life as archaeologists began to uncover their ancient cities. Decipherment of the Hittite script and their Indo-European language made it possible to trace their origins to the 2nd millennium BC, when Aryan tribes began to migrate from the Caucasus area, some southeast to India, others southwest to Asia Minor. The Hittite kingdom flourished circa 1750 BC and began to decline 500 years later. It was then that the Hittites were harassed by incursions from across the Aegean Sea. The Hittites spoke of the invaders as the people of Achiawa. Many scholars believe that they were the very same people whom Homer called Achaioi. The Achaicans, whose attack upon the western tip of Asia Minor he immortalized in the Iliad. For centuries prior to the War of Troy, the Hittites expanded their kingdom to imperial proportions, claiming to have done so upon the orders of their supreme god, Tishub, the Stormer. His olden title was Storm God Whose Strength Makes Dead, and Hittite kings sometimes claimed that the god had actually taken a hand in the battle. "The mighty storm god, my lord," wrote the king Murshiles, "showed his divine power and shot a thunderbolt at the enemy, helping to defeat it." Also aiding the Hittites in battle was the goddess Ishtar, whose epithet was Lady of the Battlefield. It was to her divine power that many a victory was attributed, as she came down from the skies to smite the hostile countries. Hittite influence, as many references in the Old Testament indicate, extended south into Canaan. But they were there as settlers, not as conquerors. While they treated Canaan as a neutral zone, laying to it no claim, this was not the attitude of the Egyptians. Repeatedly the pharaohs sought to extend their rule northward to Canaan and the Cedar Land, Lebanon. They succeeded in doing so circa 1470 BC, when they defeated a coalition of Canaanite kings at Megiddo. The Old Testament, and inscriptions left by the Hittites' foes, pictured the Hittites as expert warriors who perfected the use of the chariot in the ancient Near East. But the Hittites' own inscriptions suggest that they went to war only when the gods gave the word, that the enemy was offered a chance to surrender peacefully before hostilities began, and that once a war was won, the Hittites were satisfied to receive tribute and take captives. The cities were not sacked, the populace was not massacred. But Thothmes III, the pharaoh who was victorious at the Battle of Megiddo, was proud to say in his inscriptions, "Now His Majesty went north, plundering towns and laying encampments waste." Of a vanquished king, the Pharaoh wrote, "I desolated his towns, set fire to his encampments, made mounds of them. Their resettlement can never take place. All the people I captured, I made prisoners. Their countless cattle I carried off, and their goods as well. I took away every resource of life. I cut down their grain and felled all their groves and all their pleasant trees. I totally destroyed it. It was all done," the Pharaoh wrote, "on the say-so of Amun-Ra, his god." The vicious nature of Egyptian warfare and the pitiless destructiveness they inflicted upon a vanquished foe were subjects of boastful inscriptions. The Pharaoh Pepi I, for example, commemorated his victory over the Asiatic sand dwellers in a poem which hailed the army which hacked up the land of the sand dwellers, cut down its fig trees and vines, cast fire into all its dwellings, killed its people by many tens of thousands. The commemorative inscriptions were accompanied by vivid depictions of the battle scenes, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 1. Adhering to this wanton tradition, the pharaoh Pi Anki, who sent troops from Upper Egypt to subdue the rebellious Lower Egypt, was enraged by his general's suggestion that adversaries who survived the battle be spared. Vowing destruction forever, the pharaoh announced that he would come to the captured city to ruin that which had remained. "For this," he stated, "my father Amun praises me." The god Amun, to whose battle orders the Egyptians attributed their viciousness, found his match in the God of Israel. In the words of the prophet Jeremiah, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I will punish Amun, god of Thebes, and those who trust in him, and shall bring retribution upon Egypt and its gods, its pharaohs, and its kings." This, we learn from the Bible, was an ongoing confrontation. Nearly 1,000 years earlier, in the days of the Exodus, Yahweh, the God of Israel, smote Egypt with a series of afflictions intended not only to soften the heart of its ruler, but also as judgments against all the gods of Egypt. The miraculous departure of the Israelites out of bondage in Egypt to the Promised Land was attributed in the biblical tale of Exodus to the direct intervention of Yahweh in those momentous events. "And they journeyed from Succoth, and encamped at Etham, at the edge of the desert. And Yahweh went forth before them, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light." There then ensued a sea battle, of which the Pharaoh preferred to leave no inscriptions. We know of it from the book of Exodus. "And the heart of the Pharaoh and his servants was changed with respect to the people, and the Egyptians pursued after them, and they overtook them encamped by the sea. And Yahweh drove back the sea with a strong east wind all that night, and dried up the waters. And the waters separated, and the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon dry ground." At daybreak, when the Egyptians realized what had happened, the Pharaoh ordered his chariots after the Israelites. But it came to pass at the time of the morning watch that Yahweh surveyed the camp of the Egyptians from the pillar of fire and cloud, and he stunned the Egyptian camp and loosened the wheels of their chariots, making their driving difficult. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for Yahweh fighteth for them against Egypt." But the Egyptian ruler pursuing the Israelites ordered his chariots to press on with the attack. The result was calamitous for the Egyptians. And the waters returned, and covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the host of the Pharaoh that was following them. Not one of them remained, and Israel beheld the great power which Yahweh had shown upon the Egyptians. The biblical language is almost identical to the words of a later pharaoh, Ramses II, used by him to describe the miraculous appearance of Amun-Ra at his side during a decisive battle fought with the Hittites in 1286 BC. Taking place at the fortress of Kadesh in Lebanon, the battle pitted four divisions of the Pharaoh Ramses II against forces mobilized by the Hittite king Muwatallis from all parts of his empire. It ended with an Egyptian retreat, cutting short Egypt's northward thrust toward Syria and Mesopotamia. It also drained Hittite resources and left them weakened and exposed. The Hittite victory might have been more decisive, for they had almost captured the pharaoh himself. Only partial Hittite inscriptions dealing with the battle have been found, but Ramses, on his return to Egypt, saw fit to describe in detail the miracle of his escape. His inscriptions on temple walls, accompanied by detailed illustrations, which can be found in the bonus PDF under Figure 2, relate how the Egyptian armies had reached Kadesh and encamped south of it, readying themselves for the battle. Surprisingly, the Hittite enemy did not step forward to do battle. Ramses then ordered two of his divisions to advance toward the fortress. It was then that the Hittite chariots appeared as if from nowhere, attacking the advancing divisions from behind and causing havoc in the encampments of the two others. As the Egyptian troops began to flee in panic, Ramses suddenly realized that His Majesty was all alone with his bodyguard, and when the king looked behind him, he saw that he was blocked off by 2,500 chariots, not his own, but of the Hittites. Abandoned by officers, charioteers, and infantry, Ramses turned to his God, reminding him that he finds himself in this predicament only because he had followed the God's orders. And His Majesty said, "What now, my father? Amen. Has a father begotten his son? Have I ever done anything without you? Whatever I did or did not do, was it not in accordance with your commands?" Reminding the Egyptian god that the enemy was beholden to other gods, Ramses went on to ask, "What are these Asiatics to you, O Amun, these wretches who know nothing of thee, O God?" As Ramses went on pleading with his god Amun to save him, for the god's powers were greater than those of millions of foot soldiers, of hundreds of thousands of chariot soldiers, a miracle happened. The god showed up on the battlefield. "Amun heard when I called him. He held out his hand to me, and I rejoiced, and stood behind me and called out, 'Forward, forward, Ramses, beloved of Amun, I am with thee.'" Following the command of his god, Ramses tore into the enemy troops. Under the influence of the god, the Hittites were inexplicably enfeebled. Their hands dropped to their sides. They were unable to shoot their arrows, nor raise their spears. And they called unto one another, "This is no mortal who is among us. This is a mighty god. His deeds are not the deeds of a man. A god is in his limbs." Thus unopposed, slaying the enemy left and right, Ramses managed to escape. After the death of Muwatallis, Egypt and the Hittite kingdom signed a peace treaty, and the reigning pharaoh took a Hittite princess to be his principal wife. The peace was needed because not only the Hittites, but also the Egyptians were increasingly coming under attack by peoples of the sea, invaders from Crete and other Greek islands. They gained a foothold on the Mediterranean coast of Canaan to become the biblical Philistines, but their attack on Egypt proper were beaten back by the pharaoh Ramses III, who commemorated the battle scenes on temple walls, which can be found in the bonus PDF under Figure 3. He attributed his victories to his strict adherence to the plans of the All-Lord, my August Divine Father, the Lord of the Gods. "It was to his god Amun-Ra," Ramses wrote, "that the credit for the victories was due, for it was Amun-Ra who was after them, destroying them." The bloody trail of man's war against his fellow men in behalf of the gods now takes us back to Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, Euphrates and Tigris, the biblical land of Shinar. There, as related in Genesis 11, the first ever cities arose. with buildings made with bricks and towers that scraped the skies. It was there that recorded history began. It was there that prehistory began with the settlements of the olden gods. It is a tale of long ago, which we will soon unfold. But right now, let us return to 1,000 years before the dramatic times of Ramses II in Egypt. Then, in faraway Mesopotamia, kingship was taken over by an ambitious young man. He was called Shahrukin, righteous ruler. Our textbooks call him Sargon I. He built a new capital city, calling it Agada, and established the kingdom of Akkad. The Akkadian language, written in a wedge-like cuneiform script, was the mother tongue of all the Semitic languages, of which Hebrew and Arabic are still in use. Reigning for the better part of the 24th century BC, Sargon attributed his long reign, 54 years, to the special status granted him by the great gods, who made him overseer of Ishtar, anointed priest of Anu, great righteous shepherd of Enlil. It was Enlil, Sargon wrote, who did not let anybody oppose Sargon, and who gave Sargon the region of the upper sea to the lower sea, from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf. It was therefore to the gate of the house of Enlil that Sargon brought the captive kings, ropes tied to the dog collars around their necks. In one of his campaigns across the Zagros Mountains, Sargon experienced the same godly feat that the combatants at Troy had witnessed. As he was moving into the land of Warashi, when he pressed forward in the darkness, Ishtar made a light to shine for him. Thus was Sargon able to penetrate the gloom of darkness as he led his troops through the mountain passes of today's Luristan. The Akkadian dynasty, begun by Sargon, reached its peak under his grandson, Naram-Sin, whom the god Sin loves. His conquests, Naram-Sin wrote on his monuments, were possible because his god had armed him with a unique weapon, the weapon of the god, and because the other gods granted him their explicit consent, or even invited him, to enter their regions. Naram-Sin's principal thrust was to the northwest, and his conquests included the city-state of Ebla, whose recently discovered archive of clay tablets has caused great scientific interest. Although, since the time of the separation of mankind, none of the kings has ever destroyed Armen and Ebla, the god Nergal did open up the path for the mighty Naram-Sin, and gave him Armen and Ebla. He also gave him, as a present, Amanus, the Cedar Mountain, to the upper sea. Just as Naram-Sin could attribute his successful campaigns to his heeding the commands of his gods, so was his downfall attributed to his going to war against the word of the gods. Scholars have put together from fragments of several versions a text that has been titled The Legend of Naram-Sin. Speaking in the first person, Naram-Sin explains in this tale of woe that his troubles began when the goddess Ishtar changed her plan, and the gods gave their blessing to 7 kings, brothers, glorious and noble. Their troops numbered 360,000. Coming from what is now Iran, they invaded the mountain lands of Gutium and Elam to the east of Mesopotamia, and were threatening Akkad itself. Naram-Sin asked the gods what to do, and was told to put aside his weapons and, instead of going to battle, to go sleep with his wife, but for some deep reason avoid making love. The gods reply to him, "O Naram-Sin, this is our word, this army against you. Bind your weapons, in a corner place them. Hold back your boldness, stay at home. Together with your wife, in bed go sleep. But with her you must not. Out of your land unto the enemy you must not go." But Naram-Sin, announcing that he would rely on his own weapons, decided to attack the enemy, in spite of the god's advice. When the first year arrived, I sent out 120,000 troops, but none of them returned alive, Naram's sin confessed in his inscription. More troops were annihilated in the second and third years, and Akkad was succumbing to death and hunger. On the fourth anniversary of the unauthorized war, Naram-Sin appealed to the great god, Ea, to overrule Ishtar and put his case before the other gods. They advised him to desist from further fighting, promising that in days to come, Enlil will summon perdition upon the sons of evil, and Akkad would have respite. The promised era of peace lasted about 3 centuries, during which the olden part of Mesopotamia, Sumer, re-emerged as the center of kingship, and the oldest urban centers of the ancient world, Nippur, Lagash, Isin, Larsa, flourished again. Sumer, under the kings of was the center of an empire that encompassed the whole of the ancient Near East. But toward the end of the 3rd millennium BC, the land became the arena for contending loyalties and opposing armies. And then that great civilization, man's first known civilization, succumbed to a major catastrophe of unprecedented proportions. It was a fateful event which, we believe, was echoed in biblical tales. It was an event whose memory lingered on for a long time, commemorated and bewailed in numerous lamentation poems. They gave a very graphic description of the havoc and desolation that befell that great heartland of ancient civilization. It was, those Mesopotamian texts stated, a catastrophe that befell Sumer as a result of a decision of the great gods sitting in council. It took southern Mesopotamia almost a century to be resettled, and another century to fully recover from the divine annihilation. By then, the center of Mesopotamian power had shifted northward, to Babylon. There, a new empire was to rise, proclaiming an ambitious god, Marduk, as its supreme deity. Circa 1800 BC, Hammurabi, the king renowned for his law code, ascended the throne in Babylon and began to extend its boundaries. According to his inscriptions, the gods not only told him if and when to launch his military campaigns, but were literally leading his armies. Through the power of the great gods, the king, beloved of the god Marduk, re-established the foundations of Sumer and Akkad. Upon the command of Anu, and with Enlil advancing in front of his army, with the mighty powers which the great gods gave him, he was no match for the army of Imutbal and its king, Rimsin. To defeat more enemies, the god Marduk granted Hammurabi a powerful weapon called Great Power of Marduk. With the powerful weapon with which Marduk proclaimed his triumphs, the hero Hammurabi overthrew in battle the armies of Ishnuna, Subartu, and Gutium. With the great power of Marduk, he overthrew the armies of Sutium, Turuku, Kamu. With the mighty power which Anu and Enlil had given him, he defeated all his enemies, as far as the country of Subartu. But before long, Babylon had to share its might with a new rival to its north, Assyria, where not Marduk, but the bearded god Asher, the all-seeing, was proclaimed supreme. While Babylon tangled with the lands to its south and east, the Assyrians extended their rule northward and westward, as far as the country of Lebanon, on the shores of the Great Sea. These were lands in the domains of the gods Ninurta and Adad, and the Assyrian kings carefully noted that they launched their campaigns on the explicit commands of these great gods. Thus, Tiglath-Pileser I commemorated his wars in the 12th century BC in the following words: Tiglath-Pileser, the legitimate king, king of the world, king of Assyria, king of all the four regions of the earth, the courageous hero who is guided by the trust-inspiring commands given by Asher and Ninurta, the great gods, his lords, thus overthrowing his enemies. At the command of my lord Asher, my hand conquered from beyond the lower Zab River to the upper sea which is in the west. 3 times I did march against the Neri countries. I made bow to my feet 30 kings of the Neri countries. I took hostages from them. I received as their tribute horses broken to the yoke. Upon the command of Anu and Adad, the great gods, my lords, I went to the Lebanon mountains. I cut cedar beams for the temples of Anu and Adad. In assuming the title King of the World, King of the Four Regions of the Earth, the Assyrian kings directly challenged Babylon. For Babylon encompassed the ancient region of Sumer and Akkad. To legitimize their claim, the Assyrian kings had to take control of those olden cities where the great gods had their homes in olden times. But the way to these sites was blocked by Babylon. The feat was achieved in the 9th century BC by Shalmaneser III. He said thus in his inscriptions, I marched against Akkad to avenge and inflict defeat. I entered Cutha, Babylon, and Borsippa. I offered sacrifices to the gods of the sacred cities of Akkad. I went further downstream to Chaldea, and received tribute from all the kings of Chaldea. At that time Asher, the great lord, gave me scepter, staff, all that was necessary to rule the people. I was acting only upon the trustworthy commands given by Asher, the great lord, my lord who loves me. Describing his various military campaigns, Shalmaneser asserted that his victories were achieved with weapons provided by two gods. I fought with the mighty force which Asher, my lord, had given me, and with the strong weapons which Nergal, my leader, had presented to me. The weapon of Asher was described as having a terrifying brilliance. In a war with Adini, the enemy fled on seeing the terrifying brilliance of Asher. It overwhelmed them. When Babylon, after several acts of defiance, was sacked by the Assyrian king, Sennacherib, its demise was made possible because its own god, Marduk, became angry with its king and people, and decreed that 70 years shall be the measure of its desolation, exactly as the God of Israel had later decreed for Jerusalem. With the subjugation of the whole of Mesopotamia, Sennacherib was able to assume the cherished title King of Sumer and Akkad. In his inscriptions, Sennacherib also described his military campaigns along the Mediterranean coast, leading to battles with the Egyptians at the gateway to the Sinai Peninsula. His list of conquered cities reads like a chapter in the Old Testament: Sidon, Tyre, Byblos, Akko, Ashdod, Ashkelon, strong cities that Sennacherib overwhelmed with the aid of the awe-inspiring brilliance, the weapon of Asher, my lord. Reliefs that illustrate his campaigns, as the one depicting the siege of Lachish, which can be found in the bonus PDF under Figure 4, show the attackers using rocket-like missiles against their enemy. In the conquered cities, Sennacherib killed their officials and patricians, and hung their bodies on poles surrounding the city. The common citizens I considered prisoners of war. An artifact known as the Prism of Sennacherib preserved an historical inscription in which he made mention of the subjugation of Judea and his attack on Jerusalem. The quarrel Sennacherib had with its king, Hezekiah, was the fact that he held captive Pari, the king of the Philistine city of Ekron, who was loyal to his solemn oath to his god Asher. As to Hezekiah, the Judean, Sennacherib wrote, who did not submit to my yoke, I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. Hezekiah himself I made captive in Jerusalem, his royal residence. Like a bird in a cage, I surrounded him with earthworks. His towns, which I had plundered, I cut off from his land, and gave them over to Matinti, king of Ashdod, Pati, king of Ekron, and Silabel, king of Gaza. Thus I reduced his country. The siege of Jerusalem offers several interesting aspects. It had no direct cause, but only an indirect one, the forced holding there of the loyal king of Ekron. The awe-inspiring brilliance, the weapon of Asher, which was employed to overwhelm the strong cities of Phoenicia and Philistia, was not used against Jerusalem. And the customary inscriptional ending, I fought with them and inflicted defeat upon them, is missing in the case of Jerusalem, Sennacherib merely reduced the size of Judea by giving its outlying areas to neighboring kings. Moreover, the usual claim that a land or a city was attacked upon the trustworthy orders of the god Asher was also absent in the case of Jerusalem. One wonders whether all this meant that the attack on the city was an unauthorized attack, a whim of Sennacherib himself, but not the wish of his god. This intriguing possibility becomes a convincing probability as we read the other side of the story, for such an other side does exist in the Old Testament. While Sennacherib glossed over his failure to capture Jerusalem, the tale in 2 Kings offers the full story. We learn from the biblical report that in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came upon all the walled cities of Judea and captured them. He then sent two of his generals with a large army to Jerusalem, the capital. But instead of storming the city, the Assyrian general, Rabshakeh, began a verbal exchange with the city's leaders, an exchange he insisted on conducting in Hebrew so that the whole populace might understand him. What did he have to say that the populace ought to have known? As the biblical text makes clear, the verbal exchanges concerned the question of whether the Assyrian invasion of Judea was authorized by the Lord Yahweh. And Rabshakeh said unto them, "Speak ye now to Hezekiah. Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is it wherein thou trusteth? If ye say unto me, We trust in Yahweh our God, now then, am I come against this place to destroy it without Yahweh? Yahweh did say unto me, Go up against this land and destroy it." The more the ministers of King Hezekiah, standing upon the city's walls, pleaded with Rabshakeh to cease saying these untrue things in Hebrew and to deliver his message in the then language of diplomacy, Aramaic, the more did Rabshakeh approach the walls to shout his words in Hebrew for all to hear. Soon he began to use foul language against Hezekiah's emissaries. Then he started to degrade the king himself. Carried away by his own oratory, Rabshakeh abandoned his claim to have had Yahweh's permission to attack Jerusalem, and went on to belittle the god himself. When Hezekiah was told of the blasphemy, he rent his clothes, and covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of Yahweh. And he sent word to the prophet Isaiah, saying, "This is a day of trouble, of rebuke, of blasphemy. May Yahweh thy Lord hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master the king of Assyria hath sent to scorn the living God." And the word of the Lord Yahweh came back through his prophet Isaiah, concerning the king of Assyria, "The way that he came, he shall return, and unto this city he shall not come in, for I shall defend this city to save it." And it came to pass that night that the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And at sunrise, lo and behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed and journeyed back and dwelt in Nineveh. According to the Old Testament, after Sennacherib had returned to Nineveh, it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the temple of his god Nisroch, that Adrammelech and Sherezar, his sons, smote him with a sword, and they escaped unto the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. Assyrian records confirm the biblical statement. Sennacherib was indeed so assassinated, and his younger son Esarhaddon did ascend the throne after him. An inscription of Esarhaddon, known as Prism B, describes the circumstances more fully. On the command of the great gods, Sennacherib had publicly proclaimed his younger son as successor. He called together the people of Assyria, young and old, and he made my brothers, the male offspring of my father, take a solemn oath in the presence of the gods of Assyria, in order to secure my succession. The brothers then broke their oath, killing Sennacherib, and seeking to kill Esarhaddon. But the gods snatched him away, and made me stay in a hiding place, preserving me for kingship. After a period of turmoil, Esarhaddon received a trustworthy command from the gods. Go, do not delay. We will march with you. The deity who was delegated to accompany Esarhaddon was Ishtar. As his brother's forces came out of Nineveh to beat off his attack on the capital, Ishtar, the lady of battle, who wished me to be her high priest, stood at my side. She broke their bows, scattered their orderly battle array. Once the Ninevite troops were disorganized, Ishtar addressed them in behalf of Esarhaddon. Upon her lofty command, they went over in masses to me and rallied behind me, Esarhaddon wrote, and recognized me as their king. Both Esarhaddon and his son and successor Ashurbanipal attempted to advance against Egypt, and both employed weapons of brilliance in the battles. The terror-inspiring brilliance of Ashur, Ashurbanipal wrote, blinded the pharaoh so that he became a madman. Other inscriptions of Ashurbanipal suggest that this weapon, which emitted an intense, blinding brightness, was worn by the gods as part of their headgear. In one instance, an enemy was blinded by the brightness from the godhead. In another, Ishtar, who dwells in Arbela, clad in divine fire and sporting the radiant headwear, rained flames upon Arabia. The Old Testament, too, refers to such a weapon of brilliance that could blind. When the angels, literally emissaries of the Lord, came to Sodom prior to its destruction, the populace attempted to break down the door of the house in which they were resting. So the angels smote the people at the entrance of the house with blindness, and they were unable to find the doorway. As Assyria rose to supremacy, even extending its rule over Lower Egypt, its kings, in the words of the Lord through his prophet Isaiah, forgot that they were only an instrument of the Lord. Ho, Assyria, the whip of mine anger! My wrath is the rod in their hands. Against impious nations I send thee. Upon people who have crossed me I charge thee. But the Assyrian kings went beyond mere punishment. Rather, it is in its heart to annihilate and wipe out nations, not few. This went beyond the intention of the God. Therefore the Lord Yahweh announced, I shall hold to account the king of Assyria, on account of the fruits of the growing haughtiness of his heart. The biblical prophecies predicting the downfall of Assyria indeed came true. As invaders from the north and east were joined by rebellious Babylonians from the south, Ashur, the religious capital, fell in 614 BC, and Nineveh, the royal capital, was captured and sacked 2 years later. The great Assyria was no more. The disintegration of the Assyrian Empire was seized by vassal kings in Egypt and Babylonia as an opportunity to attempt the restoration of their own hegemonies. The lands between them were once again the cherished prize, and Egyptians, under the pharaoh Necho, were quicker in invading these territories. In Babylonia, Nebuchadnezzar II, as recorded in his inscriptions, was ordered by the god Marduk to march his army westward. The expedition was made possible because another god, the one who held the original sovereignty over the area, has not desired the cedar land any more. And now a foreign enemy was ruling and robbing it. In Jerusalem, the word of the Lord Yahweh through his prophet Jeremiah was to side with Babylon, for the Lord Yahweh, calling Nebuchadnezzar my servant, had decided to make the Babylonian king the instrument of his wrath against the gods of Egypt. Thus saith Yahweh, Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, indeed will I send for and fetch Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. And he shall smite the land of Egypt, and deliver such as are for death to death, and such as are for captivity to captivity, and such as are for the sword to the sword. And I will kindle a fire in the house of Egypt's gods, and he will burn them, and he will break the obelisks of Heliopolis, the one which is in the land of Egypt. The houses of the gods of Egypt shall he burn with fire. In the course of this campaign, the Lord Yahweh announced that Jerusalem, too, shall be punished on account of its people's sins. having taken up the worship of the Queen of Heaven and of the gods of Egypt. Mine anger and my fury shall be poured unto this place, and it shall burn and shall not be quenched. In the city on which my name has been called, the doom will I begin. And so it was that in the year 586 B.C., Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard of the king of Babylon, came into Jerusalem, and he burned the house of Yahweh, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and all the walls around Jerusalem were torn down by the army of the Chaldeans. This desolation, Yahweh promised, however, would last only 70 years. The king who was to fulfill this promise and enable the rebuilding of the temple of Jerusalem was Cyrus. His ancestors, speaking an Indo-European language, are believed to have migrated south from the Caspian Sea area to the province of Anshan, along the eastern coast of the Persian Gulf. There, Hakam Anish, wise man, the leader of the migrants, began a dynasty we call Achaemenid. His descendants, Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, made history as rulers of what was to be the Persian Empire. When Cyrus ascended the throne of Anshan in 549 BC, his land was a distant province of Elam and Media. In Babylon, then the center of power, the kingship was held by Nabonid, who became king under most unusual circumstances, not by the customary choice by the god Marduk, but as a result of a unique pact between a high priestess, the mother of Nabonid, and the god Sin. A partly damaged tablet contains the eventual indictment of Nabonid. He set an heretical statue upon a base. He called its name the god Sin. At the proper time of the New Year festival, he advised that there be no celebrations. He confounded the rites and upset the ordinances. While Cyrus was busy fighting the Greeks of Asia Minor, Marduk, seeking to restore his position as the national god of Babylon, scanned and looked throughout the countries, searching for a righteous ruler willing to be led. And he called out the name of Cyrus, king of Anshan, and pronounced his name to be ruler of all the lands. After the first deeds of Cyrus proved to be in accord with the god's wishes, Marduk ordered him to march against his own city, Babylon. He made him, Cyrus, set out on the road to Babylon, going at his side like a real friend. Thus, literally accompanied by the Babylonian god, Cyrus was able to take Babylon without bloodshed. On a day equivalent to March 20th, 538 B.C., Cyrus held the hands of Bel, the lord Marduk, in Babylon's sacred precinct. On New Year's Day, his son, Cambyses, officiated at the restored festival honoring Marduk. Cyrus left his successors an empire that encompassed all the earlier empires and kingdoms but one: Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, and Assyria in Mesopotamia, Elam and Media to the east, the lands to the north, the Hittite and Greek lands in Asia Minor, Phoenicia and Canaan, and Philistia. All had now come under one sovereign king and one supreme god, Ahura Mazda, god of truth and light. He was depicted in ancient Persia, which can be found in the bonus material under Figure 5a, as a bearded deity roaming the skies within a winged disk, very much in the manner in which the Assyrians had depicted their supreme god Ashur, which can be found in the bonus PDF under Figure 5b. When Cyrus died in 529 BC, the only remaining independent land with its independent gods was Egypt. 4 years later, his son and successor, Cambyses, led his troops along the Mediterranean coast of the Sinai Peninsula and defeated the Egyptians at Pelusium. A few months later, he entered Memphis, the Egyptian royal capital, and proclaimed himself a pharaoh. Despite his victory, Cambyses carefully refrained from employing in his Egyptian inscriptions the usual opening formula, "The great god Ahura Mazda chose me." Egypt, he recognized, did not come within the domains of this god. In deference to the independent gods of Egypt, Cambyses prostrated himself before their statues, accepting their dominion. In return, the Egyptian priests legitimized his rule over Egypt by granting him the title Offspring of Ra. The ancient world was now united under one king, chosen by the great god of truth and light, and accepted by the gods of Egypt. Neither men nor gods had cause left to war with each other. Peace on earth. But peace failed to last. Across the Mediterranean Sea, the Greeks were increasing in wealth, power, and ambitions. Asia Minor, the Aegean Sea, and the Eastern Mediterranean saw increasing clashes, both local and international. In 490 BC, Darius I attempted to invade Greece and was defeated at Marathon. 9 years later, Xerxes I was defeated at Salamis. A century and a half later, Alexander of Macedonia crossed over from Europe to launch a campaign of conquest that saw the blood of men flow in all the ancient lands as far as India. Was he carrying out a trustworthy command of the gods? On the contrary, believing a legend that he was fathered by an Egyptian god, Alexander at first fought his way to Egypt to hear the god's oracle confirm his semi-divine origins. But the oracle also predicted his early death, and Alexander's travels and conquests were thereafter motivated by a search for the waters of life, so that he might drink of them and evade his fate. He died, in spite of all the carnage, young and in his prime. And ever since, the wars of men have been the wars of men alone. Chapter 2. The Contending of Horus and Seth. Was it a sad commentary on the history of warfare that the messianic Essenes envisioned the final war of men as one in which the company of the divine would join the congregation of the mortals, and the war cries of gods and men would mingle on the battlefield? Not at all. What the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness had envisioned was simply that human warfare shall end just as it had begun, with gods and men fighting side by side. Incredible as it may sound, a document does exist that describes the first war in which the gods involved mortal men. It is an inscription on the walls of the great temple at Edfu, an ancient Egyptian holy city that was dedicated to the god Horus. It was there, Egyptian traditions held, that Horus established a foundry of divine iron, and where, in a special enclosure, he maintained the great winged disc that could roam the skies. When the doors of the foundry open, an Egyptian text declared, "The disk riseth up." The inscription, which can be found in the bonus PDF under Figure 6, remarkable for its geographical accuracy, begins with an exact date, a date not in the affairs of men, but of the gods. It deals with events when the gods themselves, long before the pharaohs, reigned over Egypt. In the year 363, His Majesty Ra, the Holy One, the Falcon of the Horizon, the Immortal who forever lives, was in the land of Ken. He was accompanied by his warriors, for the enemies had conspired against their lord in the district which has been called Ua-Ua since that day. Ra went there in his boat, his companions with him. He landed in the district of the throne place of Horus, in the western part of this district, east of the house of Kenu, the one which has been called Royal Kenu from that time on. Horus, the winged measurer, came to the boat of Ra. He said to his forefather, "O Falcon of the Horizon, I have seen the enemy conspire against thy lordship, to take the luminous crown unto themselves." With a few words, the ancient scribe succeeded in drawing the background, as well as setting the stage for the unusual war that was about to unfold. We gather at once that the fighting was brought on by a conspiracy by certain enemies of the gods Ra and Horus to take away the luminous crown of lordship unto themselves. This obviously could have been done only by some other god or gods. to forestall the conspiracy, Ra, accompanied by his warriors, went in his boat to a district where Horus had set up his headquarters. The boat of Ra, as is known from many other texts, was a celestial boat in which Ra could soar to the farthest heavens. In this instance, Ra used it to land far away from any